This programming is sponsored by the UH Health Family Care Center, offering primary care and behavioral health services on the University of Houston campus. Health insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, accepted. New patient appointments and more at 832-UH-CARES.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Jerónimo Cortina, a political scientist and associate director at the Center for Mexican American and Latino Studies at the University of Houston.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor also here at the University of Houston. Thanks for hanging out with us and talking politics. An extremely important week. Lots of things happening. And of course, the biggest news is the leaked opinion from the Supreme Court about their intentions to potentially overturn Roe versus Wade, which is the landmark decision that gave women the right to have an abortion through a kind of penumbra of rights with respect to privacy in the Constitution. You've heard all about it. We're going to break it down for you so that we can kind of see through a lot of the kind of chaos that's happening and get a sense of what this really looks like. But it wasn't the only thing that happened to Roe this week, even though it really does feel like it. A lot of things happened this week, including primaries, which are going on in other states, including in Ohio, where J.D. Vance, who is the author of a book, Hillbilly Elegy, that was a bestseller a couple of years ago, has locked up the Republican nomination in an open Senate seat in Ohio. Why are we talking about Ohio? Well, partly because Vance is sort of famous in political circles, but also because he got a very notable boost from a one Donald J. Trump, and it seems to have done the trick for him. So is... Yeah. Vance's ascendancy here a signal that Trump's brand is still potent, or is this just a fluke?
It's a very interesting situation, right? Because obviously J.D. Vance was not the, I guess, ideal candidate for Trump to endorse, right? Because in 2016, if I remember correctly, J.D. Vance said that Trump was like cultural heroin, right? And he said that he makes some feel better for a bit, but he cannot fix what ails them. And one day they will realize it, end of quote. Right. So he was not a Trump supporter by any shape or form. But I think that at the end, this really shows that at least, right, Trump has some sort of control and can push his candidates over the top.
That's, I think, a good point. And certainly you see Trump universe helping. So Peter Thiel, who is a billionaire, gave J.D. Vance $15 million through a super PAC, not directly, through a super PAC. Just and that was basically 15? The largest. Yeah, only $15 million. Mm. This is the largest single boost for a U.S. Senate candidate in history. So this super PAC basically is doing all of this work, creating all the ads and doing all the research. And so that's interesting. But Thiel and Trump are tight. And so I think that that relationship probably smoothed over, for instance, Vance, as you said, in 2016, saying that he was, quote, never a Trump guy and, quote, never liked him. So, but you know, politics makes for strange bedfellows. And it did create some conflict here. So in Trump world, things were a bit fragmented. Look, Vance only won 33% of the vote. So it's not like he won by 50%.
Right.
It was a primary, so he just needs to get past the post. But Cruz and the Club for Growth endorse somebody else. Kellyanne Conway, who is, of course, the campaign manager and former White House advisor for Trump, backed another candidate, yet another candidate. So and Rand Paul endorsed yet another different candidate. So of the four candidates, Vance gets 33%, which isn't great. But the fact that everything was fragmented didn't give him a big boost. So he's probably going to win the Senate seat. And that's going to create some headaches for Mitch McConnell, right? Because Vance is going to join that, you know, group that like Rick Scott pushing to move in a different direction, says, I don't care about the Ukraine, you know, and going in a very extreme direction. So it's interesting to note that, you know, Trumpism is still alive and well, even if Trump might not be on the ascendancy. So we'll keep track of that and the degree to which Trump is popular. In fact, he's coming to Texas in a couple of weeks, and so that might have an effect on what happens in Lone Star State. And of course, a lot going on here, Geronimo. A bunch of border stuff going on this week. This is a reoccurring theme, as probably listeners have been picking up on. So what are the things that happened this week that struck you as interesting in terms of border politics?
Well, we have more chatter, as they say, in terms of... you know, Governor Abbott being able to use a constitutional provision, which is Article 4, Section 4, and Article 1, Section 10, saying that Texas is under an invasion, believe it or not. not the kind of invasion that we have seen Russia and the Ukraine. That is an invasion. That's right. An invasion. Everything else, it is not an invasion, right? But this thing came up a few weeks ago when Ken Cuccinelli, that was a former Homeland Security official under the Trump administration, and now he's the head's a think tank called the Center for Renewing America, said that Governor Abbott is not doing, quote unquote, enough. His responses have been inadequate so far, and that he should absolutely declare an invasion. And that would allow the Department of Public Safety, the State National Guard, et cetera, to immediately turn back migrants at the border. And all of these, right, is under, right, the issue of the border wall. In this week also, Brian Kolfage, that came to Texas around 3 years ago, he just pled guilty to fraud.
Yes.
Because
for bilking investors, yeah.
Exactly, because he took away money from helping Donald Trump's promise of building a big, beautiful wall along the U.S. border. So everything is a mess.
Right. In short, that's the tagline. It's a great point. Obviously, this is an extreme position to take to imply that the U.S. and Texas is being invaded. Matt Krause, who's a representative from Fort Worth, has asked the attorney general for a legal opinion on whether or not this is true. This is non-binding, but it doesn't seem to have stopped the government, including Greg Abbott, from using those non-binding opinions as effectively like a legal decision. So that's a different problem. So just bracket that. But the fact that this is even being discussed is unique, but not surprising in a way, because obviously the border is a big issue and inflaming the passions about it is something that riles up the Republican base. And believe me, we're going to talk all about riling up the Republican base. But I think the fact is that this is probably a step beyond where the public would like to see this go. But obviously, there's a lot of appetite for it because Texas is still pouring a bunch of money into this. Here's a great story from the week. Texas this week announced it's allocating an additional $500 million, $495 million to continue funding Operation Lone Star. This is basically a big infusion of cash. As we reported weeks ago, the operation was requesting to be able to continue these operations. The governor has touted drug seizures and migrant apprehensions as a reason that we need to keep spending this money, but the program has been the subject of controversy, as we've talked about. They've got National Guard payroll problems. There's been a lack of equipment. We had an unfortunate death of one of them in service. There's been a lot of controversy on this issue. But I want to add one more log to the controversy here, and that is that this money isn't money, by the way, that was allocated to this. This was money that was allocated to different programs. And so one thing that surprises.
Such as what?
Yeah, exactly. Which tell us what. Tell us what. So the one thing that my students are always fascinated by is that we talk about how, you know, the legislature traditionally sets the budget, right? They pass it and the governor signs it. The governor can veto it, line in to veto it. But there's an interesting quirk because during the interim, the governor can move money around and he is effectively doing that. So, and to answer your question, state agencies like Health and Human Services, the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Criminal Justice that runs prisons, Texas Alcohol and Beverage Commission, Juvenile Justice, which has had all kinds of problems, that's where the money's coming from. They're basically just taking money from one agency or a bunch of agencies to put it to the operation. So this has really, I think, created some controversy in the Republican Party because people like Matt Schaefer, who's a representative from North Texas, tweeted out saying, the legislature doesn't run the budget anymore. Basically, these three elected leaders run the budget. That's the governor, the speaker, and lieutenant governor. So this is another piece of controversy on another already controversial measure, right, that's going on. But wait, there's more. On a talk show this week, Governor Abbott implied he might actually consider challenging a 1982 Supreme Court law, that's Plyler versus Doe, that requires states to offer a free education to all children, including those of undocumented immigrants. So taken together, give us a summary of the kind of picture of the border and how it falls into the politics of 2022.
Obviously, since the 1800s, right, the border has been It has been used.
We're going way back, all the way back.
Well, I mean, you need a little bit of context to understand it, right?
True enough.
President Wilson was the first president sending troops to the border in a massive way. And obviously, the border has been used to a certain extent as a political wedge. Yeah. And has been using migrants as scapegoats, especially when economic times are not going fantastic. You know, yes. They can take the blame. So,
yes.
Politically speaking, the border has been used like that. Migration has been used like that. However, I think that now, especially Governor Abbott, has taken it on steroids, right? And yes. And this is a very, very dangerous game that he's playing. The fact that now he is trying to, as you say, ply versus dough, trying to see if they should or shouldn't. I mean, that's going extremely, extremely far. And really it hurts our, fabric of how this country was founded, right? How the country has been a compassionate country, how the country is open arms, those who want to leave places that in which their lives are in danger or seeking the American dream. Mm. So he's messing with the very, very, very own fabric of what defines America. And I think that's extremely, extremely dangerous because it's going to polarize us even more, if that is possible.
Yeah, and that it has, right? And to kind of bring this into the context for the 2022 election, the kind of recent polling suggests that the Republican Party's actually improved slightly in terms of its approval rating. It was very far underwater in August, and now it's closer to being even, 44 approve, 47 disapprove. But the problem for Democrats is that their numbers are still way low, so and unchanged. And so the strategy seems to be working, at least with Republicans. So certainly that's one problem. And the Democrats don't seem to have any kind of juice to be able to move around it. Abbott, in a most recent poll, where he's winning by about 11% statewide, is winning 40% of independents, 36% of Hispanics, and 48% of suburbs. That's not enough to beat the Democrats, but it's enough to win, if that makes sense. Like, they can't, like, control the minds of the people, right, and kind of get their people to believe it's the right thing to do, but they can get just enough to win the election, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a slight difference, but enough that, they're able to kind of use this to their advantage. Another thing that happened this last week, actually, we didn't report on last week, was that the state representative Chris Turner from Grand Prairie, who is the Democratic caucus chair in the House, basically the leader of the group, sort of legal, political leader of the group, has decided he's not going to seek re-election to that position. So there's, again, more churn inside the Democratic Party. There was dissent about whether or not the Democrats should walk out in the fight over voting rights in the special session that just happened between the old and the new members. New members wanted something more radical. Older members wanted to kind of work the system. The problem here is that they don't have a strategy. And that's creating some issues for the Democratic Party in terms of trying to figure out what they're going to do about all of this. And this was all before the leaked opinion Roe versus Wade. So where are we in the politics of basically the state? Like, what's going to happen in 22?
The Republicans are doing it, right? To a certain extent. Mm-hmm. They're doing it. They have a strategy. You see, dissenting voices here and there. But overall, there is some sort of they align themselves with, this is going to be the message. Obviously, the leader of the Republican Party in Texas, or the de facto leader, is Governor Abbott. And, also you have Lieutenant Governor Patrick, as well as, I guess the two unquestionable leaders. Here on the other side, on the Democratic Party side, we have newcomers. We have, more progressive members of the House. You have, on the other hand, more moderate members of the Democratic Party, right? And we have seen that, how it's fighting for being the chair of the Democratic Party in Texas. We see that tension going on.
Yes.
So one thing that needs to happen, right, is to have a powwow, sit down at the table, get some pencils and paper, or maybe a computer, or a laptop.
Whiteboard it.
Exactly. Whiteboard it, right? And come up with a clear strategy of what they're going to do. Because Democrats are losing traction in terms of what they're going to be doing for 2022. We are in 2022. We're in Cinco de Mayo, and the election is November. So it's
very close. Yeah.
It's very close.
After the hangover, that's when you start to plan, right? Take it to the whiteboard. And I have a light bulb idea about what it might be, and that's probably about reproductive rights. So the big story, of course, of the week is that the Supreme Court is apparently considering overturning Roe versus Wade. There was a leaked opinion that created a political earthquake. Justice Alito was the lead author on a brief that apparently got five other justices. That's Barrett, Gorsuch, Thomas, and Kavanaugh, not the Chief Justice. So five total, though, that's enough to be able to say that, as Justice Alito wrote, Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. Overturning it is the imperative for this particular brief. The other part of this is that the states should be able to have more authority to decide what they do with their policies. And there's basically then two strands of this. The first is that there's no mention of Roe in the Constitution. So this right to privacy in particular, it doesn't exist. The other is that the state should have more authority here. Republicans have pushed back for decades on judge-made law, saying that these unelected, you know, robe-wearing, you know, bureaucrats shouldn't be deciding this. But of course, now they are. And political scientists, we know that's exactly what judges do. So what do you make of, big picture here, the legal implications to this potential decision?
Well, the legal implications are huge, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and to a certain extent, they're very important in terms of what the court can do and cannot do eventually, right? They can get away with marriage equality, just like that, right? Because that was not, you know, following, you know, these restrictive, rational...
Not in the Constitution.
Justice. Exactly. It's not in the Constitution, right? You can do also, on the other hand, you know, gun rights as well, right?
Yeah.
Because in the Constitution is, and that time, they don't take into consideration automatic weapons. They don't take into consideration high-capacity magazines, right? So everyone will have to buy muskets and, you know, black powder thingies because that's in the Constitution, right?
Automatic muskets.
but you can't, right? Because at the time of the writing of the Constitution, that did not exist. Therefore, the Constitution cannot protect something that did not exist at the time of its writing. So, you know, you can do all the legal gymnastics and try to put it in a reasonable way. Yeah. But again, this is a logic that, you know, Justice Alito is reversing, or the opposite of what Plessy versus Ferguson, what happened, that, you know, to a certain extent upheld racial segregation. So the whole idea was that segregation violated the 14th Amendment. And what Homer Plessy was arguing is that you cannot leave me to the state's willing, right? Because those state willings are going to change. So the federal government has to intervene and protect my 14th Amendment rights. And it's the same thing, but the opposite, right? It's like, nope, this is not something that we should be playing, and it should be left to the state's rights. And finally, it's, you know, our federalism is going down the drain, right?
Yeah.
The federal government is just going to be a bureaucrat at the end.
Yeah, and pushing papers from state to state.
Right.
Well, it's a great point. I think that it creates a more divided America. The states' rights question is really interesting. And what the sample opinion says is that the court basically has short-circuited the democratic process by allowing a large number of Americans who dissented from Roe to have no voice. And so what the argument is that basically that the court should allow the states to make these choices because that represents more of what the people want. It's a very muscular reading of Article 10, but one that basically puts all of the policy onus back on the states. So it's going to create two Americas. You've got one America where you've got civil liberties protected, like you have a Miranda right when you get arrested. You've got the right to an abortion, you know.
Right.
Transgender, you know, children have got rights. And so these are things that you're going to see really divided because some states like California, Oregon, New York have codified these things, and some states like Alabama, Texas, and others have not. So that's a real division, as you say. So it's I don't think it's short-circuiting federalism. It's really muscularizing it, right? It's it on steroids because it's creating this situation where you've got multiple Americas and they're all doing something slightly different. Let's talk about the precedent value here, because one of the things that is noted in the text is that precedent isn't a firm guide. It is not an inexorable command. So all of these justices who signed on to this purported opinion say that when their confirmation hearings were happening, they respected precedent. Now right. They're coming back saying, well, we're going to change it. Susan Collins, who was a key swing vote on many of these justices, said, wait a minute, that's not what they said. So were they not telling the truth? Are they just being flexible in their opinions? What's going on?
I don't know, right? But I mean, that's the thing, right?
Right.
That is the thing. It's the politicization of the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And, you know, Republicans have made this argument that, you know, liberal justices and liberal judges are making policy from the bench, right? And that has been, you know, an argument that the conservatives have used over and over. And we need judges and justices that respect the law, apply the law, end of story, right? But now we're seeing the complete opposite. Now that the numbers are big enough, they're going to be able to enact policy. And, you know, one of the things that it's funny here is that they seem not to be reading public opinion, right?
Yes.
And public opinion, a majority of the country say, you know, leave it. It's fine, right? And most people agree that there should be one way or another way to have legal abortions. And the fact is that abortions are going to exist. Mm-hmm. Abortions are going to keep going, right? What it's going to end eventually, if this happens, is safe abortions.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
And that's going to be a significant point because these things are going to exist or people are going to move, right?
Yes,
or are going to travel to California. California is thinking of enacting new laws in terms of allowing people who want to go to the state of California to have a safe abortion to do so, right?
Yeah.
Personally, or at the individual level, I mean, you can agree to disagree, you can support or not support abortion, but this is a right of women to choose what they're doing with their body. So it's a very ideological, very messy argument, but should the government rule over your body? That's,
right.
You know, very complicated to understand one way or another.
Well, and it's a class issue, too. So like you say, you know, some women are not going to have a problem traveling to get an abortion. But people who don't have the money, especially women of color who would disproportionately affect, won't be able to. So, again, it's creating this divide in America. Let's talk Texas, because Texas has a trigger law like 13 other states that basically bans abortions immediately if Roe versus Wade is overturned. So Alabama, Arkansas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, all of the states that kind of border Texas also have similar laws. So basically, this is going to increase the cost of seeking an abortion and, of course, disproportionately affect poor women and women of color. So it's already hard to get an abortion in Texas. This is going to make it impossible. The difference is I'm not sure because technically it's going to be really a challenge anyway to receive an abortion. But obviously, this is going to outlaw it in a way that would punish doctors for pursuing that particular approach. Although we have local DAs saying we're not going to prosecute. So that's really where the short circuit for federalism comes, right? Where like this law says these people are like illegally doing something and local DAs say, nope, we're not going to prosecute. So that's a real problem, I think, that you noted in terms of short circuiting federalism. But let's talk about what this might mean to Texas in terms of the law, but also in terms of what's going to happen in 2022. We were talking earlier about how Democrats need a spark. This gives them that spark, right? Unenthusiastic Democrats or literate in midterm elections. This is going to probably boost that support. In fact, if you look at the polling for O'Rourke, he's not getting even a majority. He's not getting all of the Democrats. There's still some who are undecided, which is unusual. So he needs to have that rally. This will give him that rally. But it also might actually help him with some Republican women. College-educated, suburban, moderate women are likely to leave the Republican coalition even temporarily and join the Democrats because they favor these abortion rights. So like you said, the public is probably not on their side. Something like 70-80% of Texans support some degree of choice. Of course, it's all shaded in exactly what kind of choice, you know, if it's about, you know, protecting the life of the mother or in cases of rape and incest. But 65% of independents think the law should be left as it is or less strict. So there's a chance here that the Democrats could rally on this issue. It hasn't historically been the case, though. Remember 2014, Wendy Davis, who was really the kind of, you know, poster of abortion rights and kind of progressive sort of reproductive rights, didn't win. And circumstances are very different than they were. But it wasn't clear that the abortion question rallied Democrats the way that other things do. So do you think it's going to work in 2022? And what's going to be the impact?
Potentially has more likelihood to impact these rally around the issue. And and you see it in the most recent poll of our colleagues at UT and the Texas Tribune. We see that, you know, when you look at party ID, you see that obviously Democrats strongly oppose, right, over banning all abortions in Texas. But also you see that 46% of independents and 17% of Republicans strongly oppose banning all abortions, right?
Yeah.
So there you go. That's your coalition, right? Especially getting all those Democrats, getting all those independents, and getting these Republicans that said, you know what, this is too much, right? And use that as a tool to do it. The advantage over Abbott versus O'Rourke, it's around, what, 11 points, something like that?
Right.
So
this was before the abortion decision was leaked.
Right.
So yes, this could change it, but that was 11% gap before.
Exactly. So there is wiggle room, right? But again, you need to start tomorrow. Like you need to have a strategy. You need to have, you know, this is the line that we're going to use, and that needs to start from the president down to, you know, the dog catcher election in one of these whatever counties.
Right. Well, and Biden came out and said basically the MAGA crowd is the most extremist they've seen in history. I'm not so sure about that, but certainly they're pushing a very extreme line. It's unclear Congress can help, right? Because the sort of controversy is a state controversy. It's hard to get the Congress to agree. There's not a majority, a supermajority, so the Democrats could codify Roe. That was the immediate thought because they control all of the chambers of Congress and the presidency. But given the political dynamics like Joe Manchin and others who might not support it, it's going to be hard to make that happen at the federal level. At the state level, you've got people like Briscoe Cain saying that the legislature is going to take retribution against corporations that pay for their employees to leave the state to have an abortion. So that's interesting to see. Texas is obviously in flux here, right? As a lot of states are. This is going to be a major issue. And if this is the way that it's going to go, it's going to be a very, very polarized election. So we're likely to see that shake up here in weeks, right?
Yeah. No. And we're going to see how it's going to be a very dynamic issue. We still don't know what's going to happen. But obviously, we're going to keep both eyes on the issue. Not just one eye, both eyes. But
we need all four eyes.
Exactly. So, but for this week, Brandon, that's it.
A big thanks to everybody at Houston Public Media for putting this together for us, and especially to our producer, Troy Schultz, who makes us sound so good every week.
Soy Jerónimo Cortina.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. The party keeps up next week. We'll be right back.